This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings, with a 4th of July-themed show that I call I Am an American. I aired most of the pieces you're going to hear today during last July's Yin Radio show, and I've added one new piece. All of these pieces share the theme of being American. What does it mean to be an American? Are you more American if you're born here than if you choose to become a citizen? The people in today's show have thought long and hard about what it means to be American. One is from an American-born woman, Mary Matsuda Gruenwald, a Japanese-American who was held by her own country, the USA, in internment camps during World War II. I follow that with an installment from Mexican-born producer and director Luis Guerrero. We recorded just before the play that he was directing, The God of Hell, had opened in Moscow, Idaho. This play is about post-9/11 America, patriotism, and intimidation. We'll start, however, with a regular, white, small-town, all-American girl. Andrea Gibson is a poet and activist. Anna Maria Roque recorded her live performance at a slam poetry reading at Washington State University in April of this year, 2009. Here's Andrea Gibson with her poem, Good Things About America.
I write a lot of bad things, a lot of angry things about this country that we live in here. And there was just a friend of mine, Derek Brown, he was putting out a book called The Good Things About America. And I was like, I could never write anything that will fit into that book because all I write is pissed off about America. But I started writing about my hometown, and this was in the book. I grew up in a little town in the woods in Maine. So this is my Good Things About America poem. Okay. We were chubby-faced school kids, snicker bar windpipe, crab apple pirates, backward baseball cap, knee-scraped snow angels, Dukes of Hazzard dreamers, bumper car-bodied salamander catchers, Michael Jordan believers. I couldn't fly, but my hang time was 3 minutes. 10 seconds. Smart kids were stupid. Books were trees cut down. I was a tomboy in love with Malcolm Cushion. He had a birthmark the shape of Canada on his left cheek. The teachers didn't trust him. His mother was the accidental broken tooth in a bar fight. I had one black friend. Her name was Erica. She had a jackknife. She carved a gash into the center of her palm, another into mine, pressed our hands together and asked if I thought it would turn her blood white. I couldn't read her fear or hope. I thought history was over. I cried during the national anthem. Once I found a butterfly's wing on the sidewalk. I wanted to keep it, but I didn't. I knew there were things I should never find beautiful, like death and girls. On Saturdays, I walked around town with a wheelbarrow collecting aluminum cans. On Sundays, my father paid me a penny for every cigarette butt I'd pick up in the driveway. I was picking up cigarette butts when Tommy Chambers punched my tooth out. I spit on his bike seat and beat the crap out of his older brother. I started writing songs, recorded them on my ghetto blaster, and mailed the tapes to the local radio station, but they never played them because they never had good taste. My mother did. She was a secretary. Her fingernails were red, and she loved my father, who after the war became a mailman. So when I was a baby, my mother would carry me to the post office and weigh me on the postal scales. Once, years later, I got lost in the mail. The next day, I came home from college and corrected my father's grammar. When I was 10, my mother had another daughter. I'd heard babies sometimes die in their sleep. So when my parents went to bed, I'd put on my Karate Kid kimono and sneak into her room to guard her heartbeat. The heartbeat thieves didn't find her for 15 years. At 11, I discovered beer. At 13, shame. At 19, I nailed my palm to Amanda Buckner's vagina, actually drooled on her breast and said yes so loud, God couldn't disagree. But my family did, so I lost them for a while. And in that while, my Uncle Barry lost his fingers to the paper mill. My Uncle Peter lost his liver to Vietnam. My mother lost her legs to God's will. In her will, I inherit everything. The 17 photographs we didn't lose in the fire, all of them with charcoaled edges. My mother holds them to her chest and tells me she can still smell the smoke. I tell her I will guard them well. My father's freckled shoulders, my sister's brown, brown eyes, my mother's patient hands buckling my tiny blue suspenders that one December when we built a bonfire in the middle of the frozen lake and I skated around its flames with my snowsuit's frozen zipper sticking to my tongue. My mother said, smile for the camera. I can still remember the flash and that enormous fire with the ice beneath it that didn't even crack.
Today's show is I Am an American. Mary Matsuda was born in the United States in 1925. She grew up, like many American kids of that time, with a life that was simple, easy, and free. Freedom wasn't to last. Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan. At 16 years old, the American-born Mary, along with her Japanese parents and her American-born brother, who was in the armed forces at the time, were shipped off to internment camps, imprisoned by her own country. Now, at more than 80 years old, Mary tells the story of being sent out from their home, labeled family 19788, herded to trucks and trains to unknown destinations, to be imprisoned for 2 years. Mary got out, got married, became Mary Matsuda Gruenwald, and got on with a normal American life. For her and most Japanese Americans who weathered the internment camps, there was a cultural reluctance to tell of the experience because it was shameful. Luckily for us, the shame eventually wore off for Mary and she could share the story as a history lesson, as a warning, and as a reconciliation. In this installment of our I Am an American program, you'll hear her story and the value that she has found in telling it after these many years. To set the stage, I start the piece by reading from chapter 1 of her book, Looking Like the Enemy. In the midst of the complicated jumble of waterways and islands of Puget Sound, there's a slice of rural America called Vashon Island, just a 20-minute ferry ride from Seattle. In the 1920s, Vashon had large-scale industrial logging, substantial greenhouse operations, and farms specializing on diverse products such as poultry, dairy, vegetables, and berries. Today, Vashon is home for thousands of people commuting to work in Seattle and Tacoma. In 1927, my parents, Heisuke and Mitsuno Matsuda, brought my brother, Yonichi, and me to Vashon. Yonichi was 4 years old, I was two. My family leased a small berry farm and worked long days to secure a livelihood and a future for their family. Like many others, we grew strawberries and lived a quiet, self-sufficient life. By 1936, we were one of 37 Japanese families living on Vashon Island. I attended Vashon grade school with 8 grades in one building, 2 classes per room, per teacher. The majority of the students were Caucasian. But in my grade level, there were 2 Chinese students and 3 Japanese-American students out of a class of 78. My life in that idyllic setting was one of innocence and pleasure, just being one of the island kids. My parents chose Vashon to raise their kids and their family in order to protect us from the corrupting influences of modern life. But nothing could protect us from the events following December 7th, 1941, the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed.
So we lived in that place for 11 wonderful, wonderful years. We had, we were growing strawberries mostly. We had currants and loganberries and other things. I went to school with a lot of the other kids and I was just part of the community. Until December 7, 1941, and my whole world changed. It was Sunday. We had gone to Sunday school and to church. And when we got home, my father was sitting in the kitchen, at the kitchen table, head down, silent. And my mother was standing by the sink, looking off. And when we came home, as we often did, we would just say, "Kaiti kimashita," we have now come home. No response. And so my brother said, "What's going on?" And finally my dad said, one of the neighbors called and said, "Japan attacked Pearl Harbor." Boom! My brother turned on the radio and there it was.
The family listened in stunned silence, feeling, I imagine, much like we all felt as we watched the events of September 11th unfold. But there was a major difference for the Matsuda family. The attacker was the parents' home country, and it was the cultural home of the children. Mary Matsuda was 16 years old by then. Although innocent, she was old enough to have some sense of what it meant to America, and to white Americans, and to Japanese living in America like her parents, and to have some feeling of what it meant to Japanese Americans like herself. They didn't have to wait long for repercussions to touch them.
Immediately, the FBI went out into all the communities where there were Japanese people and picked up the leaders of the Japanese community. We had a small Japanese community, but we did have an association of our families. And the man who was the president was picked up that first day, disappeared, and we didn't know where he had gone. We learned years later that he, like many of his peers, were sent to Missoula, Montana. Our assets were frozen, but in time we were told we could withdraw up to $100 a month for necessities such as food. In time, we were given a restriction. We could not go beyond 15 miles, which meant that we couldn't get off the island to go to Seattle or to Tacoma for whatever reason.
While the kids at school treated her the same, Mary was different. She was no longer innocent and carefree.
I knew that in some profound way, my life would change. But I didn't have a clue of what that would be like. And I wanted to hide and run, but there was no place to hide. And I wanted to change my appearance, but there was nothing I could do.
A warning call from a friend let the Matsuda family know to expect more. It prompted them to take action, to distance themselves from Japanese culture, from their heritage, to try to avoid imprisonment. They started destroying signs of their heritage.
It was in early February, 1942. I'm 17 years old by this time. My folks had a telephone call from a good friend on Bainbridge Island, which is another island north of Vashon. And this woman said, "The FBI came to our place today, and then they went through everything. They put their hands through the rice. They opened the drawers and the cupboards and the shelves and they ransacked everything." Well, that day we went through our place, our barn, our garage, and in particular our home. And that night, my folks had a big roaring fire going in the stove in the living room. And my dad brought out all of the phonograph records, a pile of phonograph records, Japanese music, put them on the table, dining room table. And my mother brought out photographs of lovely places in Japan, letters, pictures of relatives on both sides of the family, and they put them right beside the records. And then my mother brought out our treasured Japanese dolls. These are the dolls that I didn't play with, but they were brought out in March for Girls' Day and June for Boys' Day. And so, like always, she laid it out. You know, there was a tier. She laid out this scarlet cloth, and then she placed all of the dolls there, and we looked at each of them. And finally, she brought out the books. My mother was very, very fond of history. Beautiful books, wonderfully illustrated. And she brought out also Japanese fairy tales. And we took one last look at them. And my dad said, "Okay, let's get this job done." And so one by one, they broke up each of the records, fed them into the fire. Next came the photographs, and finally came these beautiful dolls. And I think that was one of the hardest things for me to do. And lastly, the books. My mother's treasured Japanese history books and fairy tales that she used to read to us when we were kids. Thinking that if we destroyed these evidences, that it would somehow prevent us from being evacuated. But in fact, it really made no difference at all. Ultimately, when it came right down to it, we were evacuated because of the way we looked, looking like the enemy. Well, sure enough, in a week or so, I was at home washing the breakfast dishes and making preliminary plans for lunch. The rest of the family were out in the field working, and I saw this black, shiny car pull up into our driveway, and two tall white men in black suits came to the front door. Knock, knock, knock. Open the door. And one of the men said, "Is this the home of Heisuke Matsuda?" And I said, "It is." And they said, "We're from the FBI. And they showed me their badge. We would like to talk to him. Is he at home?" And I said, "No. They're all out in the field working. I'll go get them." February 19th. This is 1942. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066.
And that's when things did begin to change. Although that first visit didn't result in any immediate action, and Father Matsuda was left at his home, nothing was ransacked or taken. Mary, in fact, was impressed with how politely the agents asked her to open drawers and closets. And then they went away. But after the signing of that executive order, they knew that things would change. And things did start happening. Signs went up all over the West, announcing instructions for people of Japanese descent. Mary still has one of those signs, and she reads from it.
Some signs went up, and they looked kind of like this. And this is what it says. Western Defense Command and 4th Army Wartime Civil Control Administration. Instructions to all Japanese living on and our said Fashion Island. This is the only one that I could get. I know that nobody saved one of these from Bashan. Then it goes on to say, all Japanese persons, both alien and non-alien, will be evacuated from this area by, in our said, 10 o'clock a.m. Saturday, May 16, 1942. And then there are other instructions about what we could or could not do. And of course, my brother and I got hooked on the word non-alien. What's a non-alien? We knew that an alien were people like my parents. But what's a non-alien? Well, you know that it's illegal to imprison citizens without due process.
They did have just days to prepare, alien and non-alien alike in this family, to collect what they were told to take to prepare the house and the farm. Instruction said you had to be able to carry everything you brought, so they ordered new suitcases from Sears and Roebuck.
What would you take if you were going to be gone for an indeterminate time? You didn't know what kind of climate you were going to be in. Didn't know anything. We had 8 days to pack.
And then May 16 arrived, and it was time to go.
And so each of us got up and had breakfast. And then we cleaned up the place. And then we packed for the last time. And my memory of leaving our home was walking away from our place and our faithful dog, Frisky, and my pet cat, Kitty, sitting on the back stoop, looking at us, sensing that something was wrong. And that was the last time I saw our pets. We had to walk about a mile to our gathering place. And halfway there, we stopped, because there on the highway was lined up these covered army trucks. And standing beside them were soldiers with rifles, with bayonet, waiting for us. And from that moment on, I had the terrible feeling that in time we would all be taken away somewhere and shot and killed. And that thought never left me during all the time that we were in prison.
When they got to the loading area, they were given tags for their luggage.
And one soldier gave us three tags. This is one of the original ones. This is the only one I have left. We were to put our family name on the top, H. Matsuda, M-A-T-S-U-D-A. And we were assigned a number, 19788. And that was to go on this tag. One tag on each of the two suitcases, and the other one to be put into a buttonhole to be displayed prominently so whoever looked at us would know that we belong to this family of four. So from that moment on, I felt like we became a number.
Mary and her family were trucked to Seattle. Then they boarded trains with blacked out windows, riding without any sense of where they were heading or to what fate. They rode for 3 days, then rode a truck again to arrive in Northern California near Fresno at an assembly center. These were hastily built camps for Japanese internees, a temporary place while the government got its act together. Mary said that they were lucky because the barracks at their assembly center were new, as opposed to the old fairground or other such places that were being used all around the West. Each family got their own apartment, as they were called, one small, empty room for six people.
There was nothing in the one we were taken to. It was about 20 feet by 26 feet. And it had six cots, six blankets, and a an extension electrical cord hung from the ceiling with a bare light bulb screwed into a ceramic socket. That's all. No water, no shelf, not even a nail to hang your coat on. And so we had to meet these two older people, husband and wife. But I was so shocked that to this day I don't remember what their names were. I can't even remember what they looked like, where they were from. And we had to hang blankets to create some sense of privacy.
Uncertainty dogged Mary and her family, not knowing their fates, not controlling or even having any say in their future. After a few months at the Assembly Center, they received news of their future that would keep them uncertain.
And finally, around mid-July, we were told to pack up our things because now we were going to go to a permanent camp. Permanent camp? What does permanent mean? Does permanent mean permanently dead? Well, once again, we got on the train, and this time we went to Northern California. It's just south of the Oregon border to the camp called Tule Lake. We were there about a year.
The Matsuda family moved as part of the government segregation plan. See, there were tensions among the internees. Some were resistant and angry, and others compliant and accepting. So a questionnaire was used to determine who fell into which group, to determine who was loyal and who was not. And it caused incredible tensions among the interned.
So there was this 40-question questionnaire, and the majority of it was pretty simple. You know, education, newspapers, community activities, etc. But there were two questions. I'd like to read them for you. Question 27. Are you willing to serve in the armed forces of the United States on combat duty wherever ordered? Question 28. Will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America and faithfully defend the United States from any or all attack by foreign or domestic forces, and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese Emperor, to any other foreign government, power, or organization?
Now, those questions were for the second generation men, the Nisei. They were over 17 years old. Now, some of these people had been pulled from U.S. military duty to be interned, and now they were being asked to volunteer to be in the military again. For the women over 17 and for all first generation Issei men and women, the questions were similar, but the ramifications were different.
Question 27. If the opportunity presents itself and you are found qualified, would you be willing to volunteer for the Army Nurse Corps or the WAC? Question 28. Will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese Emperor or any other foreign government, power, or organization? Background. Remember, I told you that by law, the first generation people could not become naturalized citizens, which meant that they were still citizens of Japan. To ask them if they were qualified to volunteer for the Army Nurse Corps or the WAC? Stupid question. 28, to swear unqualified allegiance to the United States that had treated them so badly and forswear their allegiance to the Japanese Emperor, they were still citizens of Japan. If they said they would be loyal to the United States, they would be stateless. What a dilemma. Well, what happened in camp was, you can imagine the tremendous emotional turmoil. And the young men started to roam around the camp and beat people up. And so it was a real scary time. We thought our problems were solved. You know, this is going to be a good place. But we found there, to our dismay, that there was just as adamant groups in Heart Mountain who were, quote, no-no. They called themselves the Fair Play Committee. And so there was tremendous turmoil. In time, these people who were no-nos were arrested, and they ended up in places like Leavenworth, Kansas, or McNeil Island, or other federal penitentiaries.
But eventually, the internment did end. In 1945, Heart Mountain prisoners again boarded trains, this time to go home. The Matsudas were lucky. They had a home to go to. And Yonichi, who had enlisted and fought in the war, he survived, and he came home to farm. The scene in Mary's story now has shifted.
In due time, we were able to return to Vashon, and life went on. But some interesting things happened on a national scale. This was initiated by those folks who voted no-no, my peers, and many of my children's generation, the Sanseis, the third generation, who said that the government was wrong in imprisoning those of us just because of the way we looked. There was a national movement which ended up in the development of the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. And this group went around to 20 different communities in the United States, hearing for the first time the account from people who had gone through the internment. And for the first time, many of my peers, who until that time had never told their stories. And we didn't. We didn't talk about the internment because it was a shameful time in our lives. And culturally, we are not prone to complain or to talk about other people who did bad things to us. So as a people, we were silent until this wartime commission made its rounds, which ended up eventually in the most wonderful thing. On August the 10th, 1988, the Civil Liberties Act was signed into law by President Ronald Reagan. The law provided $20,000 in restitution to individuals of Japanese ancestry who were interned during World War II. There was also funds set aside for the education of the coming generations so that there would be a way for people to continue to understand what happened to a group of people who lost their liberties with the attempt so that it would not happen again. In my family, I was the only one that received this $20,000. And I have a picture of Ronald Reagan signing this act. And I have this form signed by the first George Bush, the White House, Washington. A monetary sum and words alone cannot restore lost years or erase painful memories. Neither can they fully convey our nation's resolve to rectify injustice and to uphold the rights of individuals. We can never fully right the wrongs of the past, but we can take a clear stand for justice and recognize that serious injustices were done to Japanese Americans during World War II. In enacting a law calling for restitution and offering a sincere apology, your fellow Americans have, in a very real sense, renewed the traditional commitment to the ideals of freedom, equality, and justice. You and your family have our best wishes for the future. Sincerely, George Bush, President of the United States, October 1990.
These reparations and apologies were first steps toward healing the wounds of imprisonment, the wounds caused by stripping away civil rights. But that was 1990, and that was George Bush Sr.
Things have changed a lot. And these are things I am glad the young people are here, because there is work to do and information that you need to pay attention to, because they will have direct effect on you. And I think it's good to be forewarned so that you will be forearmed.
Civil rights are being stripped away today amid our efforts to be secure. So Mary's story is a warning for today, which is one reason she tells her story, and it's why she can't remain silent.
Now, our president has found it legitimate from his point of view as a commander-in-chief during wartime, and it's true. During World War II, President Roosevelt took control and he made the internment possible. And of course, thereby we lost our civil rights. In this time, I find it impossible for me to remain silent. There is a time for being quiet, and there is a time to band together against this kind of insidious evil that permeates us under the guise of nationalism. It is not. The United States was built on our freedoms, and they should be accorded to every person who lives here. I have some strong feelings about that, obviously. Because not only because of what I have experienced, but more so because I know what it means. I know what it means to lose your freedom and be totally powerless.
And there's another, more personal reason that Mary does tell her story. See, she went away from her experience with internment with silent shame and rejection of all things Japanese.
But I think the net result of what this internment did to me was, subconsciously, I just completely cut off any thought about being Japanese. And it wasn't until I wrote my book that I realized what I had done. And that's why I say, for those of you with white or gray hair like me, write your story. Not only does it convey a legacy for your children and grandchildren, etc., but there is an incredible process that goes on in your mind and your feelings, and the kind of understanding that comes from doing that.
By writing her story, Mary made a realization about others as well. The no-nos, those disloyals. With understanding of them, she found even more healing.
It was in the writing of my story. It was in researching in depth why they would be willing to go to a federal penitentiary and pay thousands of dollars in fine. What I learned was that they were protesting the way they were treated. That is the inherent right of an American citizen to dissent. 2 years ago, I went to Tule Lake. There was a pilgrimage to Tule Lake. And it was an opportunity for me to make a public confession. This came directly from writing this book. And there was the wife and the two sons of a family where the man and his wife had both voted no. But I said, I came for the explicit purpose of making a public apology for my self-righteous condemnation of the no-no group without really understanding the meaning of their right to differ with me. And I wept publicly. And those two sons, particularly the older son, wept uncontrollably because he had told me that his father had felt like a pariah all these years because he had been denounced by former neighbors, business associates, etc. And the damage that it had done to his life was irreparable.
Through recognition, Mary and others could reconcile. By telling the story, she found forgiveness.
So that's why I say, you know, writing for your children and grandchildren is an incredible gift. Not only for them, but also what you learn about yourself and why you did what you did. So tell your stories as vividly as you can.
It took Mary more than 60 years to regain what she lost in the internment camps. Now in her 80s, she found her voice, and she uses it. Our next installment in this I Am an American show on Yin Radio is called The God of Hell. Luis Guerrero directed the Sam Shepard play The God of Hell in October 2007. Just a week or two before the play opened, he sat down with me to talk about it in my living room with wind chimes and street sounds in the background and all of that. The story that we talked about was not the story I was expecting to talk about. The God of Hell is a play with a message. It's not a subtle message. It was written a couple of years after September 11th, when the first reactions were just being taken by the U.S., when Americans were living in fear. And the messages we got were that we had to demonstrate a certain kind of patriotism if we wanted to be called patriots. The God of Hell is a farce, practically a melodrama. A mysterious man knocks on the door of a farmer couple in the middle America with a sales pitch. He's pushing American-made cookies. He seems to know about the couple and the house and the equally mysterious house guest, who's a friend of the husband. The friend is hiding from some mysterious horror. This salesman is apparently looking for this man and selling American flags, intimidating and badgering and crossing the boundaries that the simple countrywoman is trying to set while her husband is down seeing to the cows. The play is silly. It's really over the top. Yet it's not afraid to come head to head with torture and brainwashing. This is the play that Luis Guerrero chose to direct. This is the play that we talked about just before it opened. And I asked him, why this play? And here's what Luis said.
It appeals to me because at this time, I just became an American citizen. And you're the first person to know that, actually. Not the first, you're the first media person to know that. She shakes my hand.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So I was at a, I chose the play a long time ago. I mean, maybe almost 3 years ago when it was available as a manuscript. And I was so eager to read it, I didn't want to wait for it to get published. Mm-hmm. It's a Sam Shepard play, and I thought, okay, I'll just order the manuscript, even if I have to pay $40 for it, because mm-hmm. you know, it's basically a copy of of his manuscript. It's not even a published, it's not even published form. And I just basically have been sitting on the script for a while, just waiting for, I guess, the opportunity to put the show up in the way that I thought it would be possible. And Sirius Idaho Theater just said yes, and they backed it, and it's going up in the Kenworthy next week. And it's really exciting because during that time, about approximately 11 years ago, I actually applied for citizenship 11 years ago. And because of a series of events, mainly the fact that they lost my files and they went to Nebraska to an archive, it took a while for them to put all the pieces back together. And 9/11 happened, and the world changed. And so I knew it was going to be a while before all that stuff got taken care of. So sometime in January, I received a letter from Homeland Security, which is always really bizarre when one receives a letter from Homeland Security. And the letter says that sometime within the next 425 days, I would be receiving an appointment letter. So when that time came, I'm glad it didn't take 425 days. I realized I was getting a lot closer. Didn't realize that I was going to be directing the play at roughly the same time that I was going to become a citizen. But that all sort of just sort of came together, you know. And so I was sworn in as an American citizen on September 15th. A few days after 9/11, and it was very profound.
In conclusion, I wish simply to say, welcome, my fellow American citizens.
Very theatrical in many senses, and I think they did an excellent job of making people feel welcomed. Even the police in L.A. were nice that day.
You were in L.A.
I was at the L.A. Convention Center with 4,500 other people. Yeah, the whole event was really profound. 4,500 people there to be sworn in as American citizens, and the event itself. You have the attorney, you have the federal court judge. The convention center essentially becomes a courthouse for that moment, and. The attorney comes up and says, Your Honor, before you have 4,500 individuals who have completed their citizenship application and are ready to be sworn in as citizens, and please accept their application. And, you know, it was much more eloquent than that, but the process was there. The staging of it was perfect. And so the judge stands up in his black robe, and he says, thank you very much, Mr. So-and-so, and he welcomes everybody. And it was just, from that point on, it was just all theater. Very ceremonial, you know, with a 40-foot American flag in the background and, you know, red, white, and blue ribbons everywhere and John Philip Sousa playing, you know. So it was everything you would imagine in a scene like that, but it's not a play, it's real life. There's something very profound watching 4,500 individuals from all over the world. And he mentioned, you know, where many of them were from, Russia, various countries in South America, Eastern Bloc countries, Mexico, Vietnam, you know, Asia, various countries in Asia, and everybody cheered, you know. And the swearing in, the actual oath, was really what. By the time you get to that point, you've had time already with the music, with the dialogue, with the, you know, everything that's gone on, and talking about the idea of free speech. And I think that's probably what moved me as well. Is I grew up in this country. I mean, I came here when I was five. So free speech is something I value as much as life, I would say, is the opportunity as an artist to speak your mind. You know, and know that you're not going to get shot, beat up, or disappeared. And that doesn't exist in other countries, including Mexico. You know, there is a lot I mean, even still now in Chiapas, there are issues of free speech and property and, you know, just indigenous rights as well. So it resonates very deeply with me to know that I'm doing this play that questions this idea that the administration has created of you're either with us or you're against us. And the idea that as a result of the events of 9/11 and the propaganda that's been created, that it is considered unpatriotic to question the government. And that's just inherently wrong. It goes against the history of the country. It goes against the question of the very idea of what American citizens are instilled to believe in. And this play challenges that status quo. It's just engaging in discourse is incredibly important. And what better way than do it with art rather than throwing stones at each other or rocks or bullets or whatever. You know, you just engage in the discussion. And so I'm living this fantasy in a sense. I mean, I am pursuing an artistic craft, and yet at the same time I'm also working through the idea of actually becoming an American citizen and holding a passport, where formerly I had a Mexican passport and now I have an American passport. That's really profound.
When required by law, or that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction, when required by the law, and that I take this oath and obligation freely, without any mental reservations or purpose of evasion, so help me God. By the authority vested in this court, I hereby declare you to be citizens of the United States of America.
Reprise of our I Am an American show. Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio. We're going to listen to some music as we wrap things up.
I am free to see.
for joining me for this Yin Radio show. It's a reprise of our I Am an American show, with some added new elements as well. You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Or you can find us on MySpace and Facebook. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive our electronic newsletter. Drop us a line anytime, yinradio@vpfound.org. I'd like to send out thanks to the Open Meadows Foundation in New York for their support of Yin Radio. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. Installments for this show were produced by Anna Maria Roque and Sandy Billings. The opening music is Piano Chocolate, and you've been listening to the music of Brarius to close the show with a tune called Freedom Is. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host, and I am glad you joined me. Until next week, happy days. Let him.